This podcast is brought to you by our patrons. To help support the show, visit patreon.com/haveadrinkshow.
This is your beer, liquor, and other beverage news for the week of May 12th, 2018. The Phoenix will rise again! If only they can find the recipe.
Price Tradamus strikes again.
Get a tickle with some Tabasco Dickle.
Could Brexit cost Bush Mills its Irish label? All this and more on Have a Drink News.
Welcome to Have a Drink News, the show where we cover this week's popular news and what you drink. I'm Justin Frazier. Skipping over lines in our thing.
I'm Christopher Walker.
And I'm Casey Price.
Let's go ahead and get started on the news.
Yeah, you all might notice Brittany's out sick. She is still producing, just not speaking, because she doesn't have much of a voice. So our first story, the Belgian monks of Grimbergen? That's the only way I could come up with that one.
Grimbergen.
Whose beer is mass-produced by Carlsberg, are seeking to reclaim their roots and start brewing in their abbey again. But they've come up against a problem. Four volunteer researchers have spent a year searching through the 35,000 books and files held in the library and archives of the Flemish Abbey. First founded in 1128 by St. Norbert of Xanten? That's what I'm going with. And they could not find the original recipe. That's kind of important. The monks last produced their dark brew in 1797, at which point the French Revolution shattered the monks' communal life and their abbey walls. They reinstated their home on the same site in the province of Flemish Brabant, 6 miles north of Brussels, shortly afterwards. But the monks did not brew again until 1958. But in 1958, they came to a deal for the Belgian Maize Brewery to use their brand, and today the beer is produced by Alken Maize Brewery for Belgian drinkers and by Carlsberg-owned brewery in Strasbourg for foreign markets. The Abbey has received the support of Alken Maize and Carlsberg for a microbrewery to be built in the same place as their original brewery stood until 1797. So what's great about this story, I mean, it's not great they can't find the recipe, but what's great is their abbey got burned down twice, and they have come to call them, nickname their order the Phoenix. But yeah, they're trying to. They still have the recipes for these other beers, but this is for their abbey beer. You know, the one that people tourists are coming to their abbey currently, going, "Oh, we want to try your abbey beer," and they're like, "Sorry, but we don't have the recipe. we seem to have misplaced it a couple hundred years ago."
I blame Robespierre. You start going around burning down churches because, in fairness, they had a disproportionate amount of wealth. Still, you're gonna lose things as monks run. They don't have time for proper filing systems.
Yeah, they're hoping they can get everything going because they're set to have the new microbrewery up and operational by 2020 for a New Year's reception, and they are confident
Looks
they
good.
Will find it. They even have all these old receipts for things that were purchased, like the barley and all this stuff. They just don't know how much of what.
Okay, here's what you do. You find however much they bought all at once. You dump it into one vat. 4 tons of barley or malt, just put it in there. It'll sort itself out with enough volume.
Sure, sure. They really want that original recipe, but 35,000 books and a team of four researchers combing through it all. And it said they had already looked in where, you know, they basically went and said, let's use the Dewey Decimal System. It should be here. Pretty much like that. And they went and looked, and no, it was not there.
Should be. The Dewey Decimal System should hold up. This wasn't invented at that point. Damn.
Oh, so, yeah, that's It does suck, but
yeah,
it's pretty funny.
It is, yeah. I would like them to find it. Don't get me wrong. It's just, yeah. It seems like a thing they would have checked on before they went ahead and thought, let's do the original recipe.
Yeah, they'll probably still just make a recipe up if they,
yeah,
if they can't find the original. It would be nice. They're like less than halfway through the books right now, so maybe by the time they get through them all.
Yeah. Or they'll, quote, find the recipe.
Yeah.
So what I think...
Just, yeah. What it says here, malt, barley, hops, water, and yeast. We got it.
Rather vague. So they're also... They have some nice quotes in here. They're like, you know, they could just use these quotes if it comes and they can't find it and be like, yeah, maybe people wouldn't even enjoy this medieval... recipe. It may just be not for current palates.
They're already prepping for the PR afterward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Getting well, ready.
You know what? You know what is for current palates, at least in bourbon.
Ooh.
There was a surprise result in the San Francisco World Spirit Competition, and it has left some bourbon lovers a bit surprised.
The devil, you say?
Oh, yeah. The winners of both the best bourbon and best single barrel bourbon both come from the Heaven Hill Distillery.
Oh.
And they're the same bourbon. They are both Henry McKenna single barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Also winning was the Elijah Craig small batch, which won for best small batch. Thank you for following. just having to look up. Sorry. Whenever I see that, I have to say thank you. Anyway, the Elijah Craig won for best small batch, all from the Heaven Hill Distillery. This is something as a surprise, as the Heaven Hill Distillery is not known as a high price distillery, and higher prices clearly denotes a better quality, right? Well, not according to the brand ambassador for Heaven Hill, Bernie Lubbers. Not a great last name.
I kind of like it.
I mean, it's fun, but, you know, if he can only stay on land. anyway, he says that judges are typically searching for gold dust among their winners and trying to find those top shelf brands as they're judging. And he says, quote, they step on bricks of gold to grab the gold dust.
Well, what an analogy.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting fact about these winners, Lubber adds, the recipe is the traditional bourbon recipe, the same as Evan Williams. So if you think Henry McKenna is the best bourbon in the world, as these judges did, Evan Williams is the same whiskey, just aged 5 years younger. So give it a try. It's also the same recipe used for the Elijah Craig, so it clearly seems to be working for them. This was kind of a big surprise, and also I would like to point out that Henry McKenna flying off shelves was a prediction made by one Casey Price Stradamus.
Yeah, it's a good whiskey. What can you say? Yep. The price is, you know, not only did it have all the marketing greatness behind it, but it also tastes good. Mm-hmm. Imagine that, right?
Yeah, and. Right. A lot of that was brought to us, brought to our attention also by Jim, who was saying the prices are going to start going up on it. That was one of the first real indicators we got about that. And in this area, we are starting to see it rise. Mm-hmm. It's gone up a couple bucks, I think, at most places.
There were pictures in this article of the same day the day after this announcement came out, that it... they were already completely empty on the shelves, and someone had captioned it. It says, "And so, there's just an empty spot in the shelf where Henry McKenna single barrel should be," and it just says, "And so it begins."
I had to check today when I was getting a beer for the show, and 12 bottles sitting proud with no price change at local retailers.
Nice.
the anger here from what the Lexington Herald leader talked about was from the not because it won, but the fact that this was a bourbon that was kind of a Dark Horse. It was one of those bourbons that nobody outside of the know really went to. It was kind of a lower price. You didn't have the craze that you had with even the Elijah Craig line with their victory a couple of last year. So it was kind of odd to see the rush on bourbon for an easily accessed bourbon.
The one that's and on shelves.
There's corn in them dare hills.
But yeah, it was, I mean, for a bourbon to win, that's everywhere, absolutely everywhere at a medium price point, a sub-medium price point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's, it's, you know, I'm actually, like, I'm really for it because, you know, it shows like a, at least for now, an affordable bourbon is already, you know, at your best. You don't have to be the priciest thing on the shelf to be, you know, to be the best in the world.
And do we want to put predictions? What do you all think the price will be at in the next couple of years?
I honestly don't remember the price of it right now.
It's a $28, $25 to $30 bottle of bourbon. I would say it's probably not going to outpace too much inflation. You know, this is one of those bourbons that it is a 10-year-old bottled in bond, which means that it takes 10 years to make this bourbon, and that bourbon had to be made in the same distilling season at 100 proof. So there's no way to change this anyway over the next few years. So there's a lot of restriction to it because of that. You can't just hop in and say, okay, we're going to make more of this. But they could, since they are saying that it's the same recipe as the as some of the other stuff, the Evan Williams brand.
Yeah.
And the same as the Elijah Craig, they may actually be able to take a few of those bottles and
keep them barrels
a little longer.
Yeah, keep them in the barrel and just go, you know what? Let me just move you on over. You stay there.
Now, being how it's a single barrel, too, or I think it's a single barrel. That's going to be a weird way to kind of move that, because those single barrels may be in sweet spots in the Rick houses. So that may not be possible. But either way, I think that each year, the newness of this award wears off over about 3 years. I can't remember who won it 3 years ago. I can tell you last year, but I can't tell you 3 years ago. And to be perfectly honest, last year they picked a single barrel bourbon, literally. And so everybody went crazy over the other barrels. This one, it was a single barrel bourbon, technically. But it's pretty consistent across their entire line, these bottles.
Yeah. I got nothing. I got no segues.
Yeah, I don't know how to segue this one.
Yeah. speaking of one single barrel, let's take something that's going to go into two barrels. And that would be the new George Dickel Tabasco barrel finished bourbon. It is still a bourbon because it is Tabasco finished. In fact, this new George Dickel Tabasco brand barrel finished has been aged for 30 days in Tabasco barrels. Those barrels previously held Tabasco peppers for the last 3 years, imparting a spicy flavor. So Tabasco sauce is made by sort of this fermentation process of putting salt and peppers in together inside of barrels, and they sit for a few years. I think in Louisiana.
Yeah, and they use spent bourbon barrels.
Yep. So, along with many others, but bourbon is one of the big ones. So one of the big things about that is that they took this recipe for George Dickel and just threw it inside of a barrel and let it sit there for a few weeks. They say here that George Dickel, Tennessee Whiskey, and Tabasco are two of the most iconic brands the South has to offer for a reason, the craftsmanship that goes into both products. But both brands with a rich history decided to collaborate and come together to create this bottle of whiskey, Tennessee whiskey, that is coming in at, hold on a minute. It would not be bourbon. I take that back.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think that's,
Tennessee whiskey, yeah. Okay. Tennessee whiskey. Number two, bottled at 35% ABV.
Oh.
So below the 40% ABV that's required for bourbon. Mm-hmm. Will be available in May throughout the U.S., so it should be popping up on shelves if you haven't already seen it. They suggest when you're serving it, you serve neat with a celery salt rim or with pickle juice and ice chaser.
No, not just that. That whole thing, that whole description there just sounds like one giant heartburn.
Now, I like the bottle. The bottle is shaped to look exactly like a Tabasco bottle, sort of. It's got the red cap with green plastic underneath it.
Yeah, I love the bottle.
It's a good look. But here's the other thing. Why haven't we seen a beer aged in Tabasco barrels yet?
That is an excellent question. I've not come across one.
Is there something about Tabasco peppers that don't lend itself well to the traditional pepper beer?
Well, you could do, especially with these spicy stouts really coming into their own.
Okay.
You may see this happening soon.
I'm looking up right now. There are a few things that are about four beers that I've seen aged in Tabasco barrels here on a quick search. Six Rivers Brewery has a chili pepper ale aged in there. There is a Gosa.
Okay.
Tastes like burning.
Now I've had tequila barrel aged Gosas before, and that was pretty amazing.
I could see that.
Six Rivers comes up with, well, that's there, and then that Elliott Bay comes up with a Tabasco Stout. So that one, I don't know if it's a barrel age though. It just says it's Tabasco. Yeah, in Tabasco barrels, steeped with cacao and blended with beer.
So I gotta say, I think we need to find a bottle of this, and we need to do a tasting.
I think so too. I think we could definitely. I don't know what the heat's going to be on this just yet, but
that's what I want to know.
it's also going to be available in a 50 milliliter bottle size, so okay. Shots are possible.
Let me just get the antacids ready.
Go ahead and get those Tums out.
It tastes chalky on something.
But, yeah, speaking of things that may not be able to be called bourbon.
Well, I don't think we ever called these bourbon.
No, we didn't, but.
Indeed, the early ancestor to bourbon, Irish whiskey. Irish whiskey might be about to get caught in Brexit wars. Bum, bum, bum. For 400 years, Bushmills distilled close to the banks of the River Bush. Who knew? In Northern Ireland, and it has.
Are they close to mills that are there?
Probably, I would assume so. And they viewed themselves as Irish whiskey. Note, I just said Northern Ireland, technically not Ireland. Now, some people across the border. Some people across the border in Ireland say it risks losing that tag after Britain leaves the European Union. The whiskey question is a microcosm of the complexities facing Britain and the EU as they seek to forge a new post-Brexit trade relationship. The EU protects Irish whiskey made on both sides of the border, as it does champagne in France or Parma ham in Italy. The worry is whether that will continue after the UK exits the bloc. In the final EU...
That makes the EU sound much more like the Soviet bloc.
It kind of does. So in the final EU-UK agreement, it's vital that protected spirits produced in Northern Ireland continue to be labeled product of Ireland, according to the Alcohol Beverage Federation of Ireland, which represents drinks companies. The EU closely guards its geographical indicator system, whereby names capture the origin and reputation of a product. For example, Slovakian distiller can't sell its product as an Irish whiskey, just as Spanish winemakers can't make champagne.
So when they say a geographical indicator system, I just immediately thought of the, what were they called? The PK something meters from Ghostbusters.
Oh,
They're just
PKE.
Like,
the PKE meters.
PKE, yes.
So for Bushmills, like, this whole thing is coming down to... because of the Irish Civil War and Northern Ireland being kind of part of the UK and the rest of Ireland being independent air quotes, independent. When Brexit officially occurs and the ties are severed with the European Union, that means Northern Ireland will be within the UK, separate by the government. And the EU is the one who is governing all of these alcohol laws that say, like, port can only be made in this certain area, and champagne can only be made in Champagne, and like that, it's the European Union that is governing all of this. And what they're calling into question is what's going to happen with Irish whiskeys that currently under this umbrella, the EU is like, yeah, we're, you know, if you trace it up far enough, when you get up to the EU, it's like, yeah, we're kind of governing this in both Northern Ireland and Ireland, so we're okay with it. But as soon as they don't have a say in what's happening in Northern Ireland, they're going, is it going to stay an Irish whiskey?
Like, Ireland could push to make it, to contest that claim.
But we're not part of the EU, and yet they still protect bourbon.
Exactly. And so, when you chase this story down deep enough, what it all boils down to is whether or not, this is all hypothetical, and right. It comes down to whether or not the UK is going to respect these laws and designations. And if they don't, will the EU revoke that for Northern Ireland in retribution? So they're saying, like, if suddenly to do commerce with some other nation, the UK somewhere, someone starts making a wine and they're calling it a port. Obviously, if it's being made in the UK, it's not a port. And if they continue doing this, even after the EU is like, hey, that's not a port, you need to stop, and they're going to like, well, screw you, we're going to keep doing it, the EU could go, well, hey, you know, Bushmills and all your Irish whiskeys being made in Northern Ireland, guess what? Technically not in Ireland, because we redrew those borders. So, not an Irish whiskey.
Okay, I see a little bit closer. So, they're worried because it's kind of right on the edge of what is legal. It would be like,
it's a technicality. It's a big technicality.
So in my idea here, you know, the word for bourbon or the law for bourbon says that it has to be made in the U.S. Well, we could technically say the Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, and therefore any of these liquors made there could also be called bourbon. I don't know if that's true or not, but it would be very similar in that case. So if the U.S. were to pull out of NAFTA, would NAFTA support the bourbon regulation?
Yes, that is a very close thing, and that's it. It's really picking
for that area, not for the U.S. in general, but just for that one area.
It's really picking some nits, but because I don't think Bushmills is not in any danger of not being called an Irish whiskey. It's just as the article points out, you may see some, not contradictory, but if you don't understand exactly how Britain, the UK, Ireland, Wales, and Scotland all, you know, commingle with each other, the labeling might get a little wishy-washy for you here in the future, because it will be a product, it'll say Irish whiskey, product of the UK.
I'm just saying, maybe England and Northern Ireland can work out some kind of deal with Ireland. I mean, there's not really a long history of disagreements there. They should be able to hash something out.
Oh, no. They're even in the article. If you tracked this article down to go through it from the Star, they're bringing up Sinn Féin and all this stuff, and I didn't want to get into Irish politics because usually
we don't.
Assassinations happen when you bring up Irish politics.
All right. Well,
Bring this mood up a little.
Well, let's keep over across the pond.
All right.
And let's go a little north of England, and let's talk about BrewDog. BrewDog has been doing very well for itself lately. So well, in fact, that it's trying to make a British TV show. Dragon's Den, Eat Some Crow. BrewDog, who has raised £56 million to date, which is very heavy, and is currently three quarters of the way through its fifth funding round via crowdfunding, and it's expanding to a U.S. through a facility in Ohio, is reminding the producers of the British TV show what they missed when they turned it down to appear on their show as a, quote, bad investment. BrewDog had been slated to show up on the BBC version of Shark Tank in 2009, which is called Dragon's Den, when they were pulled at the last minute, being claimed they were a bad investment. So some how do you like me now comments about a decade later, taking those aside, BrewDog is pretty happy with how things turned out. The co-founder, James Watt, said, "Since producers turned us down, we have gone on to build a pretty neat little business, which is currently valued at £1.8 billion, which has raised over £250 million. We have been able to pitch and had any of the dragons invested, that £100,000 would now be worth a whopping £360 million. It would have been by far the most lucrative investment, not only in the history of Dragon's Den, but pretty much in the history in investment history overall. Looking back, despite how much of a setback it was at the time, we were very happy that we got turned down. It forced Martin and I to go back to the drawing board in terms of how to finance the business. As a result, we created a model that lets people who enjoy our beer own a part of our company. Equity for Punks would not have existed without Dragon's Den's rejection. Equity for Punks is their crowdfunding platform. They now have a community of 75,000 equity punks, punk investors all over the world who are the heart and soul of the business. The Dragon's loss was our amazing equity punks gain. It definitely worked out the better in our eyes. So, yeah. I guess maybe good news for anyone who gets turned down on Shark Tank here in the U.S.
Yeah, just always realize you may be able to turn around. Just because those people were like, oh, it's a bad investment, you might be able to turn around and be like, yeah, we're worth a few billion now. So,
That's a pretty hard, oh, just imagine what you could have had if you had only given us that £100,000 back then.
Yeah, but as they've pointed out, would they be the company they are today if they had received that endorsement?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe not. The having the people who buy from you as part owners does really incentivize you to stick with that particular brand, so it creates a extra layer of loyalty there.
Yeah, not to get super local again, but you saw it with Braxton. Braxton pretty much knew they had a local fan base that was going to support them because they had all the early backers on the internet.
Kickstarter.
And that
internet thing.
Yeah, they were one of the last major local Kickstarter successes that we saw. And that was because that was crazy. It was like within a week or two, they were like triple over their goal and everything. And now they're just bathing in the profits. Whether I don't know if that's true or not, it just seems that way.
And they have their big money, Ben. Well.
they are doing quite well for themselves. Yes,
haven't they done well?
All right. Speaking of people who might do well for themselves in the future.
People who do well for themselves right now. We've got the best college beer. No, I'm not talking about that beer that you go and buy for $8 a 12-pack. I'm talking about
Natty Light right here. Yes. It is.
I am talking about brewing schools in the nation. They just had their most recent U.S. College Open Beer Championship. The beer championship goes and pits college student brewers against each other with beers that they brewed either at their own facilities or brewed at home and are submitting them with their professor's approval.
So I would like Beard Lint to be part of this, part of the judging on this.
I can't help but picture something that's robot fighting, for some reason I'm picturing that. Because it was always these small college groups that were together.
Like the battle bots.
Yeah, we have whatever team from MIT over here. So this one is you have these small college brewing schools coming together, like, oh, we have the team over here from whatever school, and like it cuts over there, and you've just got a full setup of like homebrew equipment, and they're all working away, like, oh, what's he doing now?
Watch as he gets that hop edition. Oh, that's oh, he's
daring
that's the timing of a champion there.
He's going for the double dry hop.
Guys, can we do color commentary for this?
I think this is perfect. We need a iron brewer of sorts.
It's going to be a real slow middle part. Once everything starts to ferment, and it's just like, yeah. Oh, watch that bubble.
That's where we'll really have to earn our money. Is that going
to
be?
And
like
everybody's just sitting there for the next hour waiting for it to ferment. Well. Yeah, so the U.S. College Beer Championship for colleges and universities that teaches for college and universities that teach brewing courses was held in North America here. So there were 17 colleges. This is the third year that they've had it. The United States and Canada both participated. SUNY, the State University of New York, and Morrisville is the new Grand National Championship as the college that brews the best beers in North America.
USA,
New York University.
USA! USA!
They took home gold for their Krupp Pilsner, a silver medal for their Arsenal IPA, and a bronze for Belgian Draft Horse Belgian Triple. The SUNY Morrisville students responsible for the school's championship performance were Mary Cosenza, Josh Alley. Michael Coons was their submitting professor. So if you're interested in finding a college that is doing really well out there and maybe you have some good students that you can get some information from, that could be a good place to look. Now, here's the weird thing about this competition. There are only five categories that you can enter in, which I thought was really weird compared to national championship or national homebrewer conventions where you've got somewhere around 70 some odd categories plus just for beer. So
they're really broad categories, like need you to make me a lager, need you to make me an ale, need you to make me a stout.
Very close. So you've got Belgian styles, Bavarian styles, stout styles, IPA, and open, which is basically other. Yeah. So
general brewing.
Yeah. open category, students could enter any style of beer they wanted to brew. Central New Mexico Community College came in second, while Metropolitan State University in Denver finished third. Other states that were up there the Gazelle that won gold in the Belgian category from Cincinnati State College. And then to mention a few of those from Michigan, who actually took home quite a few. You had the Schoolcraft College in Michigan, Kalamazoo Valley Community College in Michigan.
Kalamazoo, that's kind of like this budding brewing area, right? Like there's just some home brewers around Kalamazoo, but I mean the scene is just starting to blossom.
Yeah,
I mean no major breweries near there.
Not
I don't
several,
think.
No, but not dozens by any means.
And then you also have Michigan State University and Central Michigan University with the state schools that came in. So Michigan really won out on this one, but they were taking home a lot of bronze too. Auburn University brought home a bronze for their Hop Sauce IPA.
Do they Roll Tide? Do they?
Alabama? No.
I forget who does what. I don't sports ball all the time.
Are they Go Pig? War
Maybe.
Pig? I don't know.
Go Me.
But anyway, write us and let us know.
Someone is shouting at this right now, going, "You morons!"
Look, we can't be Josh and Chuck. I don't know if you listen to stuff you should know, but they always, whatever school is called out, they can within 10 seconds name the mascot.
Then also last on not last, but in the open category, there was a dark matter beer. I'm assuming it's just a dark beer of some sort from Appalachian State University in North Carolina. Yeah. So other than that Cincinnati school, they are probably the closest to us.
Still, that's I wonder how much like some of the bigger breweries are like looking at some of these going, find me those kids that won. We need brewers.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm looking a little bit deeper into the list. And so there are more categories that they that the U.S. Beer Championship goes into, but you win by becoming the best in your specific category, it looks like.
To be the very best, like no one ever was.
I'm glad I'm not the only one whose mind went there. He started saying it, and then I just heard that guitar wail suddenly in my head.
We can't tell you which schools are which in terms of football.
But we can.
But you
sing.
Ask us to give you the Pokemon theme. We're your guys.
All right. So, speaking of Michigan and the Great Lakes. Researchers at the University of Minnesota have found microplastics.
Minnesota
found microplastics in 12 brands of beer made with water from the Great Lakes. The study also found plastic contamination in sea salt and tap water from around the world. That is actually pretty disturbing. The study was led by UMN School of Public Health graduate student Mary Kosuth. With assistance from microplastics expert Sherry Mason of State University of New York at Fredonia.
It just sounds made up.
That's
when you say
it's so long. And overseen by UMN School of Public Health Associate Professor Betsy Wattenberg.
Like when usually they just say SUNY Fred.
When you have to preface something that heavily, you're like, So the team sampled 12 brands of beer from large brewers and craft brewers from around the Great Lakes. In every sample, microscopic plastic fibers and particles were detected. Most of the fibers were smaller than 5 millimeters in length. Wattenberg said that what was interesting about the beer samples was a discrepancy in the amount of plastic contaminated in the final product. The amount of microplastics detected in the beer didn't necessarily match the amount of microplastics detected in the water that was used to make the beer. And that sort of suggests that the plastics can be introduced at different steps in the process of making beer. And that brought up a really good question to me. Casey, how the hell could that be possible?
Well, I have another question before we get too deep into that. Is it possible that just the things they're holding their samples in are contaminated by microplastics?
They're
looking for through something else, but like in every sample, I was like, I mean, did you control for the fact that, like, I'm just picturing them there with like a plastic, like a jug, and just going, yep, there's some water. I'm sure that's not how it went.
No.
Go ahead, Casey.
So the micro fibers, those specifically could be coming from many different sources. So if they're using various different types of bags to transport their malt, if they're getting bagged malt and they're using that to dump it right into the mash tun, that could be causing microfibers. Could be something that the malt has on it to begin with. If you are using yeast, it's going to come in a plastic bag, and depending on how that bag's been treated and how it's been heat sealed and everything, you could get some little plastic leaching that could come from that. The process of making beer sort of it adds heat to plastic tubing. So if you're using plastic or in some cases, non-heat resistant tubing, that could add some microplastic particles into the beer at a certain.
So basically, point. Every step of the process.
I mean, there's just a lot of places that may or may not add plastic. Usually, you do not want to make beer using plastic. That's because you're actually introducing it to a porous environment that's really hard to clean.
I would say because plastic melts and you don't want to put that over the cooker.
Yeah, that too. So there's a lot of opportunities, I think, for the plastics to be introduced. And it could be that, you know, one of the malt producers is downwind from a plastic company. And it could be something as simple as that. So, I don't know exactly how they are getting through this. Beer companies will usually filter their water through either even a chlorine filter. But again, I don't know how small of a particle those will strip out.
I was going to say, I think it would have been interesting if the beer, in fact, had less plastic than the water.
Yeah, the beer is safer than water, maybe. But we don't know necessarily what microplastics do to the body just yet.
Yeah, that's
turn us into plastic.
A lot of this research is just the beginnings to figure out what that's causing, because as this article is going on, the team also collected 159 tap water samples from around the world and found that 81% of the samples from 14 countries were contaminated with microplastic fibers and granules. I got some quotes here. I think what was surprising was the widespread contamination, that the contamination was detected in tap water throughout the world in many sources of tap water from both urban sources and rural sources in both developing countries and developed countries. So this is a worldwide problem, especially when it's in the salt. So, like, when it's in sea salt, meaning you can go and buy shakers of sea salt and there are microplastic fibers hanging on that salt.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, but I
don't know enough about what this is going to do to us yet to want to freak out.
It might just be passing harmlessly through our bodies and we just pass it, you know, it doesn't get absorbed and it's just a thing that's around.
Or it's going to make us live for 1,000 years.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the microplastic, at least from what I've read and looked, the microplastics don't necessarily damage us as much as they damage the wildlife.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, more the real reason why microplastics have been kind of taken against. But I'm sure there are... You know, we got into what's the chemical that's in water bottles that everybody went crazy with, PBDs or
BPA.
BPA. So, you know, PB&J. It could be that it's leaching some sort of product that we don't want in the body, and that actually does in large amounts cause some problems. Who knows? And so I guess that's what we need to do research for and see what's going on.
Yeah.
From what I'm reading on a CNN article, they're too big to be absorbed by our cells, but they could be broken down and absorbed into the circulatory system, passed through the organs. So what happens? Does it make
clots?
Exactly. Does it allow it to blood to clot around that and cause strokes and in microcapillaries? What's going on there? So there's a lot to be researched, and I think nobody knows the right answer right now. But I think it's something that's definitely needing to be looked at, because do we need to come around and reverse osmosis filter everything that we make beer out of? And then the salts that we put back in, are those going to contain microplastics?
Yeah, because
how do we pull it out of that?
Yeah, and that's another thing, actually. If you're treating your water with salts, that may be the reason that you've got it. That would be more accurate, probably, because if you're treating your water with water salts, that's probably one of the biggest ways that these things are getting in, because you're taking those dehydrated salts that are made to make your beer closer to a water from another place. So you're taking all the particulate matter in those salts and adding it back to the beer. So that may be a very good place that these could be introduced.
My only thing is, when I hear stories like this, all it makes me think of is that we need to go out into a stream, out into untouched nature, and drink from that instead. Mm. And that's why I'm like, oh.
Well, this said it was everywhere, rural communities and everything. Like, there's no escape. No escape!
Out of glaciers.
Yeah.
Right. So
I'm gonna drill straight into that glacier.
So Casey, speaking of science gone awry.
All right, and this isn't necessarily a big story, so we're just going to touch on it a little bit this week. But Kettle Brand Potato Chips is now releasing a bourbon barbecue flavor made with a combination of sweet southern barbecue flavor and the richness of bourbon whiskey. Variety clocks in at 140 calories per serving and is non-GMO. How about
Maniacs!
That? Each 8.5-ounce bag retails for a suggested $3.79. I probably won't be buying any of those. Actually, 8-ounce bag's a pretty big bag, isn't it? Not like a single serving.
Look, for my dad's birthday, I bought him sirloin steak-flavored potato chips. I will buy these.
Also, a single serving is the one that says family size, Casey.
Okay. Yeah, I was with a group this past yesterday, actually, and we were talking about, you know, everything's getting barrel aged. So you know, why not just barrel age potatoes and make, and then here comes this the next day I see bourbon barbecue potato chips, barrel aged potatoes, basically.
You were thinking a different kettle was going to be barrel aging potatoes.
Yeah.
Kettle one.
Because
that's where I thought this was going when I heard kettle, and I was like, oh, we're getting like vodka?
We need to talk about some branding things. All right. So we are, I think.
Are we all finished? All right. Okay, well, we'd like to remind everyone that this is our news-only show, but we do a weekly long-form show discussing the science and history of around what you drink. If you'd like to hear that and want to support Have a Drink, please go to patreon.com patreon.com/haveadrinkshow. And we'll see you next Sunday at 7:30 p.m.
Saturday.
Eastern Standard Time, the only time zone that matters. Once again, I'm Justin Fraser.
I'm Christopher Walker.
And I'm Casey Price. We'll see you Sunday.
Saturday.
Saturday.
Whenever.
One day.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.